Well, thanks for inviting me to participate here today and to comment on this report. Now, as outlined in the report, there are several potential components to a viable decarbonization agenda: renewables, nuclear, CCS, transmission, efficiency, storage, and so on. I approach this talk tonight from the viewpoint of a response to the report, which is different from the viewpoint, say, of a businessman or a venture investor in these technologies, because it asks whether a dramatic cost reduction, or I want to ask whether a dramatic cost reduction at scale is amenable to a global coordinated effort. And in that context, where are the best opportunities? So this evening, I'm going to focus mainly on renewables, electronics, which hasn't quite been mentioned, but you'll see what I mean, and storage, partly because I have the most to say there, and there's a time constraint, and I expect that aspects of CCS and nuclear will come up in the discussion. In fact, I have never either spoken or been present at a discussion on energy at the Foundation of Science and Technology in this room that nuclear hasn't come up. No matter what the topic was, nuclear always comes up in the discussion. As you would expect, I will be very opinionated in what I say, because why break the habit of a lifetime? I will close by making some remarks on what I feel is an unhelpful response on these issues that's been coming from some of our industrial colleagues, that's emerged over several years, but has been particularly prominent in the last 6 months, and which I think is a barrier to progress along this line. And I'll be specific, you'll see what I mean. Okay, my first point. This is about science, engineering, scaling up of manufacturing, and a process of industrialization. Now, not all of these, in my view, are equally amenable to a global program. It would be unusual if scientific breakthrough were required and it could be orchestrated by a global coordinating body. But where that breakthrough has occurred, even at an early stage, the engineering challenges can be parceled out and tackled in parallel to make progress at pace. And likewise, for certain things, as you'll see, I'll be specific about these, there are manufacturing and industrialization challenges. Each renewable and storage technology is different, and each one is at its own particular state of development. Therefore, I think it makes some sense to discuss them specifically, and that's what I'm going to do. So my second point is a quick scamper through a number of renewables technologies. And let's start with solar, because David has already spent quite a lot of time on solar. Solar costs have come down markedly, as shown in that graph, on the panels. But that's one part of the cost of a solar installation. I think it's important to recall that for small-scale solar, solar on rooftops, you compete with retail electricity prices, not with wholesale electricity prices. So you should not compare wholesale and retail, and the retail pricing structures that you have in each country will affect whether solar is at parity today. So there are people in California who during the day have to pay 35 US cents a kilowatt hour for their electricity. And solar on their roof is much cheaper than that without any subsidy today. Depending on where you are in the world, for a lot of the world today, solar is already at parity with coal, and in some places it's much better, especially in critical places. So in Nigeria, for example, where I've been working for the last year, the electricity in the northern half of Nigeria, when it exists, is all supplied by diesel. The diesel is trucked in over 600 miles every day. And the cost, most of which is subsidized by the government, is 47 US cents a kilowatt hour. Now, solar could cut that by 80%. It can't actually do that because nobody will supply solar at a cost of capital that would allow that reduction. But a 25, 35, 50% reduction in the cost of electricity is well within range with today's technology, silicon technology. And of course, we have many places where there's no electricity, especially in Africa. 600 million people in Africa have no electricity, and there solar is by far the best thing to do today. One other thing to say about solar, it can be used at every scale. So in Kenya, in Uganda, people have little solar panels that they put on their roof. They buy a kit for $300 from a company called M-Kopa, and they use it to provide lights and sell, and charge their cell phones and so on. And you can do everything from that up to 100 megawatt solar installation. There's no other energy electricity technology that we have that works at every scale. Clearly, as David indicated, there are new PV materials that are at various places on the sort of conveyor belt from laboratory to commercialization. And some of these are just going to fall off the conveyor belt. Perovskites are the ones that have had the most publicity lately, and I've done two BBC programs because the BBC seems quite fascinated with perovskites. But there's a long way to go, and if things went well with perovskites, we would have commercial materials in the early 2020s, I would say. A global program might be useful for sorting out which of the things on the conveyor belt are likely to make progress, what are the barriers to progress, and which are further along. But in my view, it may not be necessary because the demand pull for new solar materials is so strong that there are plenty of companies and plenty of existing industrial enterprises to pull this along. And the manufacturing base that you need is so similar to that for other electronic products that you can do this at scale. However, there is still an opportunity, and particularly for large installations, for cost reduction in everything but the panels, the so-called balance of plant, because there hasn't been nearly the speed of cost reduction on balance of plant as there has been on the panels. And I think that a globally coordinated program, breaking this down into components, could be very productive. Because it is mentioned in the report, although it was not in David's slides, I want to say a word about concentrated solar thermal. Now, this is viable. It's been done at scale in California and will soon be implemented at scale in other places in North Africa and the Middle East. But it is very expensive. It's much more expensive than what we're talking about here. And basically, it's low tech. There are an array of mirrors, and these mirrors focus the sunlight, the heat, effectively the infrared, onto a tower or some other configuration and make steam using conventional turbines. I don't see that any big effort is going to result in a step change in the costs of this because it's just not there. There's nothing that someone can put in place as a roadmap that says if we do this, this, and this, you're going to reduce the cost. And this is not about mass manufacturing because you build a few of these things. Okay, now I want to turn to wind. Onshore wind is cheap, and it has taken its place with nuclear as one of the major suppliers of electricity in many countries of the world, including this one. While the report says that we need to step up investment to resume the cost reduction, the progress in cost reduction, I think I disagree with that. And if we look at what's happened with the cost of wind, over 20 years, really from 1989 to 2009, costs came down a long ways, and we're now in the flat part of the curve. I am not sure that there's a big opportunity to make another step change in this. But what we can learn is the lesson that this took 20 years, and it didn't need to take 20 years. And if so, that is much too slow. If we look, turn our attention to offshore wind, the situation looks completely different. A concerted effort on offshore wind will take out one third of the cost of offshore wind today. People have identified where you can take out a third of the cost, and I think that further industrialization will take out another big chunk of costs. The trick for offshore wind is to accomplish in 5 years what it took 20 years to accomplish for onshore wind. And in my view, offshore wind is the best candidate for a breakthrough from a global program. There's a lot to do, and parallel processing with coordination is the key. You know, the thing that distinguishes wind, and offshore wind in particular, is that we are talking about thousands and thousands of turbines. So this is an industrial process, and you need all the techniques of industrialization, how you make the blades, how you handle the blades so none of them break, how you do the installation. All of these things are costs and costs and costs that can come out. And compare this with nuclear, where we're talking about not thousands, but tens of nuclear plants. You can't get the same breakthrough because you're doing too few. Okay, I want to touch briefly on marine. There's a lot that could be said about wave and tidal power, but I'll be very brief. I think this is a tempting target for a global program because there's a big resource, a huge resource, and the costs are very high today. But I worry that the effort here would be wasted. The costs are so high, and the conditions, especially for ocean energy, are so difficult that I think the mountain is too big to climb. A lot of major industrial players, Rolls-Royce, ABB, and others, have been in this, have tried hard, and have given up. And I just think we need to be very careful before launching yet another effort on this, or at least see a convincing roadmap that would say, if you did this, you could get there. Okay, all of these technologies, wind, marine, and solar, require storage, about which more in a moment. I just want to touch on biomass, because I think there's still great reason for optimism, and this can have such a big impact at scale, across geography, without storage. We need to look globally at what's the best way to do this. What are the best crops, in inverted commas? It took me a long time in this country to say inverted commas instead of quotes. Accept the truths about the impacts, environmental impacts, sustainability impacts, where these are hard truths, but also destroy some malicious untruths that are put out and that stand in the way of progress. This biomass is very amenable to an Apollo-type effort. And the reason it's amenable to that is because of the systemic nature of the problem. Links to advances in biotechnology that lead to concentration, leads to advances in food production, decisions about land use globally, farmers' income, and so on. And the last thing I want to say on renewable technologies is just to mention renewable heat, and not to forget about heat. Heat is too neglected as an area of opportunity, and there's a lot to do beyond just efficiency. It requires lots of clever engineering, and the difficulty with it is that even in the developed world, even across the EU, we do things so differently in each country that it's very hard to find a technology that can be broadly applicable. But with our venture capital hat on, I've seen probably 100 different renewable heat ideas, and some of my colleagues are in the back there. We've looked at literally 100 of these possible solutions, and I think these need to be screened and selected for what's prospective and pushed to scale. This, again, is very amenable to the Apollo-type effort and will be a big contributor in colder climes. And while we're at it, renewable cooling might also have some quick wins. And now my third point, electronics and storage. In the absence of cheap storage, there have been great advances in electronics particularly the electronics, for easy switching between generation technologies. And this is very useful and important because it allows, for example, solar and diesel to work together and for the user not to notice when you're generating with solar and when you're generating with diesel. And, for example, there are tea plantations in Kenya that do this and look economic. When is it economic for me to be using solar? When is it economic for me to switch to diesel? This needs to be cheap, it needs to be invisible to the customer, and it needs to be able to work quickly, so cloud cover, abrupt changes in wind direction, and so on. And at a range of scales, from kilowatts to megawatts. And while much has been done, I think we could see this as a key component for an Apollo-type effort. And finally, storage. I think we can all agree that storage is absolutely crucial, and it is one of those areas of investment that have no regrets. No matter what we do, we will always make use of energy storage. Whatever other technology progress occurs, we'll gain from advances in electricity storage. We need it across scales. The biggest opportunity for me is still in lithium-ion batteries. Costs have halved, and then they halved again, and we now have advances which are just starting to emerge from the laboratory and into nascent companies, which would get you to the $100 per kilowatt hour for lithium-ion batteries. Lithium-ion batteries could be cheaper than lead acid within 5 years, in my opinion. And this changes everything. But it requires everything as well. It requires science, engineering, manufacturing, testing, cycling, all sorts of things. Because I'm a chemist by training, I'm basically pessimistic about new batteries. New batteries are limited by the periodic table. There are only so many combinations, and most of them have been tried. But there are lots of new materials, graphene. There are new manufacturing techniques like lithium-ion, semi-liquid batteries, and so on. And these much better engineering of these things will make a difference. I am also a big supporter of flow batteries. For utility scale storage. And at the moment, the chemistry of flow batteries, and we don't have time to explain it here today, but it's in the report, the chemistry of flow batteries is well established. And you can either get flow batteries that are very reliable and very expensive, or very unreliable and very cheap. Now, in that situation, it should be possible to get high reliability and cheap. And this may be just the right sort of engineering challenge for an Apollo team. Okay, my last point, and then I'm going to stop. In the last 6 months, and really it came into focus for me with the speech of Ben Van Beurden at the IP dinner, Institute of Petroleum dinner, last February, and it's been increasing in volume since then. There have been some comments, primarily from the oil and gas industry, that I think work against progress on the agenda. These messages are as follows. First, that we need to shift from coal to gas in the developed world because renewables will not be big enough, will never be big enough to take the place of coal, let alone gas and oil. And as a corollary to this required shift, we need to exploit shale gas to the maximum. Now, it's the message on renewables heard over and over again that I think needs to be most concerning to us. Second, develop CCS for coal in the developing world, coal in the developing world, and for gas in OECD. And this means the developing world, the corollary to this is that the developing world needs to build more coal-fired power stations because these will be cheaper than renewables. Even though this is clearly not the case, Viscount Ridley is the leading and the loudest proponent of this myth in columns in the Times. He's had several on them. And others pick it up from him and repeat it as if it was true. I'm a little bit pessimistic about CCS. That's well known. And I want to make clear that it does not solve all the sustainable development problems of coal. It may solve the CO2 problem. There are many other problems. And again, in sub-Saharan Africa today, we can build PV at scale for less than coal, especially if it is new-built, state-of-the-art coal with equipped for CCS, and you also have to build the whole transmission infrastructure that goes with it. Third message is establish a carbon price globally. Fine, very advantageous suggestion when you know that political consensus on a global basis is completely impossible. And at low fossil fuel prices, it wouldn't probably hurt demand that much. But it's particularly advantageous if you're a gas supplier because it says switch from coal to gas. And finally, the assertion that oil will continue to be the overwhelmingly dominant fuel for transport for the rest of this century. It doesn't fit with the decarbonization targets that are required. It might be true, but it fails to recognize our ability, say, to do aviation with biofuels, and certainly our ability to decarbonize electricity, make progress on storage, and make cars twice as efficient. So I conclude by saying that there's a great opportunity that a big, well-funded global program, if properly focused, can make a difference, because while science breakthroughs don't usually happen from such programs, engineering and industrialization does, which is good, since that is where the big opportunities lie. But an essential part of what we need to do, in addition to all of this, is to robustly counter untruths about renewables versus fossil fuels that are repeated over and over again. Thank you.